This is the Grinlian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's Beyond the Fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grinlian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
Live from the Bunker South in beautiful Weatherford, Texas. That's right. This is the mouth of the South, Micah Hanks. Further south tonight, as we're broadcasting from Skeleton Studios, the home of Expanded Perspectives, which we're going to call the Bunker South, still hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth. Welcome to the program. I am Micah Hanks, and you've locked into the Grinlian Report, broadcasting worldwide on the KGRE Radio Network. Now, as long as our audio drivers will hold out, I'm, of course, glad to be your host, and tonight we're going to be delving into the mysteries of Texas. And in order to help me do this, as I had mentioned, as I'm traveling, the fine hosts of Expanded Perspectives have made available to me their studio facilities, and I have to say, I feel like I've walked into a horror movie, but I mean that in a good way. Joining me live right here, producing and co-hosting with me, Mr. Kyle Filson of Expanded Perspectives. How are you, sir?
I'm doing excellent, Micah. How are you?
I am doing great. And also my brud over here with the beard, Mr. Cam Hale.
Howdy, everybody.
Cam Hale, who could double as Dusty Hill of ZZ Top with that beard. Jesus just left Chicago and he walked right into this studio.
That's right.
So glad to be with everybody tonight. And, you know, it's a wonderful thing when you can travel all over the country, like I am prone to do, and walk into a studio where they've got a cooler of Dos Equis beer or a bottle of water, which I happen to have right here. But there are a couple of Dos Equis on this radio platform. And then you can also have a fully functional recording studio. This is incredible. You guys have got such a wonderful outfit down here, and I'm so glad to be the guest hosting from your studio tonight.
Well, you're actually the first person we've ever had in the studio other than me and Cam, so
Oh, man.
Pretty cool.
You know, great. I was sending messages back to the guys in the Grinlian Bunker, and they were so thoroughly impressed with the studio that you guys have down here. Skeleton Studios, where does the name come from?
It comes from Kyle's boys.
Kyle's
That's where
boys.
It all started, yeah, the Brud, which is where Brud came from.
The original Brud.
The original Brud, yeah. And then they tried to say, I believe it was one Halloween a while back, and they were trying to say skeletons, and they couldn't. They could just say skeletons. So that's pretty much where it stuck and rolled out from. And then, of course, the whole Brud thing was trying to say bud or brother or something like that, and then that kind of developed into Brud, and then all of it just kind of stuck. So then it's just, that's in the vernacular of everybody else, and that's just what we use.
So good to be here in the Bunker South, a fully formidable radio studio. And speaking of those with fully formidable radio studios in other parts of the globe, outlying, still south, but a little further north of us, Mr. Race Hobbs in Master Control, Fort Smith, Arkansas. How are you there, Hobbo?
Hobbo. I'm great, Micah. Thanks for throwing it to me when I wasn't ready.
Absolutely. Boy, you're just in a peachy mood today, brother. But listen, I'm just blessed to have four overpowering southern accents on one program now. People aren't going to know what to think when they hear this.
It's the four southern horsemen.
All the races, I think Race has got that kind of voice that people, they don't care really where he's from. They just like to hear him. Every time I was at my friend Susan Davidson's house yesterday before I caught the flight down here, and we had Race on Skype, and she says, boy, he's just got a great voice, doesn't he? Race, would you do a spot for me?
A spot?
Yeah, like a radio spot, you know. You know, voice something for me sometime.
I could listen to Race just read the phone book.
I know. Yeah.
I love his voice, yeah.
You should do audiobooks, Race.
The Grinlian Report with Micah Hanks.
Yeah. See, now if you keep doing that, people are going to say, we don't want to hear your voice anymore. Just have Race come in there.
No. You are the true mouth of the South.
Sometimes I guess I'll never escape it. At least, well, until Ted Turner comes back around. So moving on to what's happening in the news. I've heard of quite an impactful event that has transpired. And actually, I'm literally talking about an impact zone on Earth found in central Australia that scientists believe is the largest asteroid impact zone on Earth. And it's been located after two collision sites were first discovered in central Australia. Now, researchers from Canberra's Australian National University announced yesterday that they had detected a 400-kilometer-wide zone embedded in Earth's crust, believed to have been caused by a meteorite splitting in two millions of years ago. Not 2 million, but a meteorite splitting in two, which transpired millions of years ago. Now, 9news.com out of Australia reported that the twin deep domes were discovered during drilling as part of a geothermal research in a surface area that straddles the borders of South Australia, Queensland, and the Northern Territory. And I'm looking at this territory, in fact, on a map, and this is truly a large swath of territory that was impacted by this meteor, or I guess asteroid, in this case, impact. Now, they note that the two asteroids must each have been over 100 kilometers across. It would have been curtains for many life species on the planet at that time. It is unclear when the event occurred, however, surrounding rocks are between 300 to 600 million years old. Now, scientists looking at the site are saying that it is a mystery. They say they also can't find an extinction event that matches these collisions, however. They say, I have a suspicion that the impact could be older than 300 million years, and large impacts like these may have had a far more insignificant role in Earth's evolution than previously thought, which is funny, because I didn't see this story until right before we went to air, but, you know, Cam, you and I were talking about this mm-hmm. earlier. The idea that, you know, cataclysmic events that may have occurred in the past could have, if not killed out all the life on Earth, obviously all the life on Earth has never been killed out, but in large part we attribute these kinds of events to the deaths of, for instance, the dinosaurs, and other species that have come and gone in Earth's prehistory. And what's interesting is that some of the theories about evolution are actually that evolution can be bottlenecked at such times, in which case a large swath of life on Earth is affected by such an event. But those which remain, for instance, if we have just a small number of humans that survive such an event, that the evolution, of course, well, you know, our actual ancestry can only be traced to those who survive, right?
Yes. Yes.
And so rather than there being, you know, for instance, hundreds of thousands of people all over the globe, in a hypothetical circumstance, and although there are actually, you know, scientific institutions that suppose that this may have happened in ancient times a few times, at least once, the idea would be that, let's say that maybe, you know, as few as 3,000 humans survive on Earth at one point, and eventually they, you know, they proliferate, of course, and they repopulate the globe, but we're all essentially descended from the survivors of these kinds of incidents. And, you know, I think that you guys had talked about hearing, of all people, I didn't know that he was into this, but Randall Carlson, who, of course, you know, friend of Graham Hancock, mm-hmm. and he's been on the Joe Rogan Experience and a lot of the podcasts, even Randall Carlson is something of a proponent, I think, of that idea, right, that there yes. may have been worlds before ours, and when we say worlds before ours, we're talking about here on Earth, but civilizations that predated what we know to be antiquity, and perhaps, and I think this is where he seems to allude to going with some of this, is that perhaps some of these actually involved advanced technological civilizations. You know, I don't know where I really stand on that. I think that maybe that there was greater knowledge in the past than what we think of today as being ancient technology. But I don't know that I would go into the realm of saying that it was something on par with what we have, like leaving Earth technology, mm-hmm. heading to the moon, or, you know, mastering the power of the atom, genetic sciences and things like that. I haven't seen evidence of that. Most would say it's preposterous. Where do you guys stand on that, though? Do you think that there could have been intelligent life that was that intelligent in ancient times?
I believe that there could have been. I believe that there was intelligent life. I don't know if I believe it to that extent. If they had the abilities like we have now. I always think of it as this, as far as the rise and fall of possible multiple civilizations, not just one that was before these cataclysms, but it could have happened several times. And I always think of it this way, as if you were to roll a stone down a hill and then pick it up and roll it again at the exact same starting point, more than likely it's not going to take the exact same path unless there's something run out for it. So if you just picked it up and rolled, it's just not going to happen. And it's kind of like rolling dice. So as you send that down, there are just little variances. So they may have been extremely advanced, and I believe that they were, but not in the ways that we were. Obviously, they were more advanced in masonry, more advanced in being able to move and quarry stone. I mean, there's lots of these things that are, and maybe they were more in tune with, I don't know, just being good folks. You know, I mean, maybe it wasn't quite as warring as it is now, or maybe it was just like it is now. I mean, war seems to be in the human's nature. It always seems like we just can't deal with peace. We love to talk about it, and we like all that, but it seems like given enough, and it goes back to that, the study that they said, if you took a box of rats, like a big, and put them in a room or like an aquarium or whatever you want to put them in, you notice to contain them, that they're okay if it's just a few. But right. once you start piling more and more and more, they start getting sketchy and things start getting bad and they start turning on each other. And that seems the way to be the human race is. So as the more that you compress them, the crazier we seem to get to have more problems. So I've always kind of thought in my mind, what if there were less people? What if back before this, maybe there were less people than, of course, what they are now? Maybe, you know, we didn't know what we know now as far as medicine-wise, but maybe food and health-wise was better. than it is now, and that's what helped us. We were more of a natural, like a homeopath, or more of a natural thing to than us taking all these medicines. So it was just a whole different balance. But because when I picture ancient civilizations, I picture them, and I don't know why, but I do. I just picture them more in tune with the world and the planet than what we are now.
I do too, and I agree with Cam and his thoughts. And I was talking with Micah this morning over a cup of coffee. I also like to think that not only were there civilizations, but much like today, like here in America, we're very advanced. We have the computer, the internet, we have Wi-Fi, cell phones, all these things. But then you can also go to a different part of the globe and find somebody in Sumatra or something that doesn't have any running water, no electricity, yet we're existing on the planet at the exact same time. So who's to say that long, long, long time ago, pre-Diluvian, long time ago, there was another advanced civilization? Much like Cam talked about, they might not have achieved flight or space travel, but it doesn't mean that they weren't advanced in other areas. But at the same time, on that globe, on somewhere else on the globe, there was the Neanderthal or something, which was completely different than Homo sapien. I mean, I think the records show that not only were they separate species, that we had branched out, hominids had branched out, that there was also commingling, interbreeding between the two.
Yeah.
So I think there was it's not a black and white issue. I think there was many things going on at the same time.
Absolutely. I agree. And as far as intelligence and technologies that may have existed, you know, again, we can look at, of course, the record of the lineage of human ancestry, and of course the different varieties of hominid species like Neanderthal.
Yeah,
we can see clear evidence of that. There isn't, again, people have argued that within just a few hundred years, that if you know, all life on Earth, or at very least if humanity were wiped out, that in a few hundred years there would be little evidence of that. But I still think that there would be certain things that carried over. And that if indeed there was evidence of an ancient super civilization, I mean, that was capable of at least something even getting in the neighborhood of what we're capable of doing today, there would have to be some evidence for that. That's just my take on it. But, you know, when it comes around to, Cam, what you were talking about, and the idea that as we spread out and as there's more and more of us, literally in terms of there just being more people, that maybe there are more problems as a result of, you know, people living in close quarters and whatnot. There have been a lot of sociological studies in the past that have, you know, kind of honed in on that. But I would look at one period in history that seems to kind of, you know, be where it all began, at least in modern times. And I'm talking in the last, you know, 100 years. And that would be right around World War II. And the reason being, of course, that we have the largest and the greatest actual conflict, an armed conflict in modern time. And what we also have as a result of the necessities for being able to win the war, the Allies and, of course, the Axis powers also becoming highly innovative with the varieties of technologies. We have technologies that stem from this period that range from everything from fiber optics to Kevlar to, of course, you know, the miniaturization of broadcast television equipment, all kinds of stuff, jet engines, I mean, you know, rocketry, advanced rocketry and projectile missiles. I mean, the list goes on, which is interesting because, you know, Kyle, before we went to air, you had brought up this story, which we actually featured at the Grailian Daily News today, in relation to, what is it now, a Nazi base?
Yeah, this comes to us from the Telegraph, and it talks about how a group of Argentinian archaeologists, while investigating the jungles there, actually came across what appears to be a Nazi lair hidden in the jungle. Now, they said that this comes, it was close to the border of Paraguay, and it's a cluster of stone structures, now covered, of course, by thick vines and accessible only when using a machete, you know, to cut through the undergrowth. And it contains stashes of German coins from the late 1930s. It has fragments of porcelain and pottery that's made in Germany. And also, there's Nazi symbols painted on the walls.
Wow.
Now, they said that we can find no other explanation as to why anyone would build these structures in such great effort and expense in a site that was at that time totally inaccessible and away from the local community. And the material that was used was not typical to that area or region. So they know that somebody had brought it there and then constructed it. Now, the man's name that was made this discovery was Daniel Chavelzon. Now, he's the leader of the team. Now, he's from the University of Buenos Aires there, and he's spent months now exploring the site. And he thinks that the fortress there that was built, the structures, had actually belonged to Martin Bormann. Now, Martin Bormann was Adolf Hitler's private secretary.
Oh, wow.
And he was in charge of funneling, they claim, a lot of the money. He had seen the writing on the wall. Martin Bormann knew that the war was coming to an end. He knew that they had been defeated before and had already started putting that stuff in the processes so that they could move to Argentina and continue their life. I mean, I remember he's the one that implemented the things like having Adolf Hitler's picture put on stamps there for the right. mail, and then a percentage of every one of those stamps sold in Germany would be put in Hitler's, you know, private financial portfolio.
That's right.
And he had made him a multimillionaire, you know, regardless of what the war wasn't all from just stealing and stuff. So he was his right-hand man. Now, the funny thing about this structure that they found here in Argentina is it was never used. They think that the site was built because they had anticipated the moving of Nazis into Argentina, and that would be a place where all the high-ups would live and their families, but they never got to. And the reason they never got to use them is because, what's his name, Juan Perón, the leader of Argentina, he just pretty much opened it up to Nazis, so they didn't have to go in hiding. They could just openly move to Argentina.
Yeah, it wasn't a secret.
It wasn't a secret, but they had built this because they thought they might have needed to do it secretly. And, you know, there's estimations from 5 up to 30,000 Nazis they know eventually ended up in Argentina. And when we had Gerard Williams on, who wrote a fantastic book called Grey Wolf, and it's a book specifically about Adolf Hitler's escape to Argentina. And he goes into great detail about Martin Bormann and how that Hitler and Eva Braun were on a submarine and it took them 2 to 3 weeks to get there.
Yeah.
And he talks about there in Argentina where this supposedly moved to. I mean, the architecture is very Bavarian. I mean, there's German beer, and you can go there now, and you can go on Adolf Hitler's birthday, Gerard said, and you can go into the local pubs, and they're still singing old Nazi songs. And it's just like everybody there speaks German. It's just common knowledge there.
See, there's no question in my mind. I mean, we know, as a matter of fact.
Of course we knew.
We knew that they had gotten down there. Now, a lot of people dispute the idea that Adolf Hitler actually survived and escaped. But you got to keep in mind that right after the war, you know, when Russia actually invades, we had some photographs that, again, you can't tell a whole lot from the photographs that were purportedly the burned body of Hitler that were found there at the Führer bunker. But there are a lot of people who have said, and there are a lot of different scenarios as to how it was carried out. You know, you've heard the submarine. We've heard about all different kinds of things. We do know that Juan Perón, and this is interesting, Joseph Farrell, alternative historian, he's researched this quite a bit. And what Farrell's take on all this is that Juan Perón and Argentina declare war on Germany right toward the end of the conflict. And they're thinking, why are they going to do that? Well, because this granted them the ability to actually land their planes following the defeat of Nazi Germany, and he believed that this is one way, one of maybe many ways, that there were people who were spirited out, and there are any number of other possible scenarios as to how specifically Hitler could have gotten out of there. But without question, whether or not Hitler survived or not and escaped, although I think that there is, I won't say conclusive, I'll certainly say there's some compelling evidence that has made me really think, yeah, but we know that a number of the Nazis, Klaus Barbie, a lot of these guys, that's exactly where they went, and this is just further proof of it.
Yeah, I mean, they know now that towards the end of World War II that Adolf Hitler was using body doubles. He had up to 2 or 3 of them.
Yeah.
And they've even showed one of his last speeches that they've reviewed the video, and they can prove that that's not Adolf Hitler. It's a lookalike.
That's so interesting. Well, you know, Saddam Hussein, I think, had been doing that. You know, many dictators have done that. Why? Well, of course, because they fear the possibility of public assassination and any number of other things. So it's a very fascinating set of circumstances. Go ahead.
Well, I think the thing that people forget is the time period. At that time, not everybody's sitting in front of a television watching, so you could be like, oh, that's not really him.
Exactly.
You're listening on a broadcast. You just assume, unless you're there where he's giving the speech, you just assume that's him.
Well, and how many pictures did anybody really see of him? You see it in the newspaper back then. It may not have been perfectly clear when it was published. If you only saw 2 or 3 pictures of somebody, you'd just be like, I didn't see enough of him to know that that's exactly what he looked like.
Yeah.
I mean, it would, something like that, I think it would be easy to pull off back then.
It's pretty compelling stuff, though.
And some of the, when you mentioned the finding the burned body of Hitler, I think they found some of the bodies of some of his other higher-ups. I don't remember exactly which one.
Uh-huh.
But they've gone back since then and done DNA samples, and it wasn't even a man. It was like DNA from 2 separate females, bones and
right.
stuff.
Right. That skull fragment that the Russians had actually had, there was a History Channel documentary, you know, back when History actually did good documentaries.
Yes, I know exactly where you're going with this.
All the networks, in my opinion, have just gone so downhill, but there was one where they had actually conducted the DNA analysis, the genetic analysis, without question, this was a portion of a skull from a female. This was not Adolf Hitler.
So the precisely. Question, so,
and
I mean,
that was supposedly the one that had been kept by the Russians that I think had actually been buried, and then they'd actually, excavated that and brought it back, and they were keeping this. And once, you know, that once science actually intervenes, they say, no, this wasn't Adolf Hitler. Now, that doesn't necessarily rewrite the entire, you know, standard narrative, but you got to keep in mind that we were kept in the dark about any details about that for decades. before even what was accepted as the general theory about the death of Hitler at the end of the war was ever really made publicly available. And so it's a very strange set of circumstances. And the more that we learn about specifically the way these guys escaped into South America, the more we learn about what was happening down there and the lengths to which they went to hide their operation and to try and persist after the war, I find it incredibly compelling. And at times I would have a hard time believing that there was not more going on behind the scenes after the war than what we know. Now, what's interesting is this can be tied in with UFOs in a very strange way. And we'll be talking more about UFOs in the second hour as we're kind of going over some of the mysteries of the Lone Star State, the fine home state of these gentlemen whose studio I'm sitting in here. But the way that people would tie this in with the UFO phenomenon, strange though it is, and this is entirely in the realm of conjecture and conspiracy theory, but, just to put it out there for the record, the idea is, of course, that there were guys like Ronald Richter, the Austrian-born physicist, who had also, and this is on record, he had actually worked for Juan Perón, following the war. But this guy had also, of course, been instrumental in, some people say he was a brilliant man. Some people say that he was just a mad fool and that Juan Perón didn't know what he was getting into with Richter. But Richter had been claiming that he was developing a new kind of physics that could be used for different kinds of propulsion, or at very least, if not propulsion, for something, a kind of physics for getting aircraft into the air and having them move at high speeds. The U.S. Air Force and other agencies took extreme interest in this, and at times he was investigated, and it was determined that Richter didn't seem to really know half of what he thought he did, and they just determined he was crazy. And most of the literature that you'll find about Richter today supports that narrative, that this was just this guy was, nutsy boo-boo, and that, he'd been hired by Perón with the hope that he was going to do something and really just didn't know how to go about it. But, the conspiratorial angle on that is that what if he actually had been developing technologies? And I'll tell you this, however unlikely that may be, to me, I don't think that we can, as I've said many times, rule out the physical nature of some UFO reports and the fact that what we appear to be dealing with is a obvious technological advancement of some kind. What we cannot prove is that this is extraterrestrial in nature. And so is it so far a leap in judgment to say that some of the craft that we see in some of the better UFO reports, is it such a leap in judgment to say that if they originated from Earth, could there be technologies that maybe, like so many other innovations, which brings us full circle, funny enough, like a saucer, yeah, that the innovations that were occurring during that time of the Second World War might have actually led to some of what we call the modern UFO phenomena. I'm equally interested and maybe even compelled by the fact that we saw so much more of that back in the 1960s, it seems, whereas, these days, well, not just the 60s, I mean, throughout the 50s, but especially I think that really the contactee era hits off. We see UFOs throughout the 50s, but things start really getting weird in the 1960s. Things continue to get weird and carry on strangely throughout the 1970s, and the weirder it seems to get, the more and more people start thinking ETs are visiting. And then, and Redfern and I have talked about this, then it just kind of drops off. So what happened after that? I mean, sure, we've had a UFO phenomena, but why is it that we just see little ambiguous lights in the sky these days? The phenomena has clearly changed, but we won't. I'll be back with the boys from Expanded Perspectives here on the Graylian Report right after this. The stars at night are big and bright, and boy, they weren't kidding, because when you get down here to the bunker south and you step outside at night and you look up at the stars, it's like something out of a film. And I thought it was beautiful above ground at the Graylian bunker back in Asheville, North Carolina. Welcome back. It is the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks, spending some time down here in the drone star state, as it's colloquially called these days. And I'm with Cam and Kyle of Expanded Perspectives. And I got to tell you, before I left town, guys, I was doing a little bit of telescoping, or we had the the Grailian Observatory, fully functional, in time for springtime. And I was looking at Jupiter the other night. I may have talked about this on one of the podcasts already. So for those who've already heard this story, bear with me. But it was so good. So beautiful. I mean, seeing Jupiter and its four moons in a straight line. And just for the first time, I haven't gotten to do any of my, you know, hobby astronomy all winter. It's just been so cold, and I just didn't feel like getting out there and freezing. And to finally see Jupiter in the sky, and to be able to zero in on it, and to observe other planetary bodies, it's incredible. And, you know, in other news, as a matter of fact, I think looking to the skies, Cam.
Yeah.
We had a little bit of news from our friend Jason McClellan at Open Minds, yeah?
Well, and he's got a great article that posted up there. Actually, I had completely... People forget about SETI and the fact that these guys are still searching and people are still looking. It's one of those things that... I guess it's kind of like NASA. That just nobody wants to throw money that way. I mean, I'm sure it's hard to get funded.
Well, you know, on a lighter note, I should say that, you know, this year I think NASA's actually gotten a better, you know, funding, you know, an amount of actual federal funding sent their way than in years past. I mean, it's actually looking to be a good year for NASA. But, you know, I digress. Go ahead.
Well, and you know, everybody's looking for ways to save money and things like that. And it sounds like that is exactly what's going on. Now, the University of California has the Lick Observatory there on Mount Hamilton, which is actually near San Jose, which a little background on that is the fact that I had no idea it was. When I saw the photographs of it, I remember it now. I remember seeing some pictures of it and things like that. But that was actually constructed between 1876 and 1887.
Really?
Yeah, that's how long that's been there.
That's crazy.
I had no idea it was that old.
I had no clue. And I was like, man.
That's incredible.
And it's one of those things, if you see it, you're just like, oh, okay.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I remember that now. But
That one.
Exactly. Well, apparently they are now using like an infrared optical like thing to shoot up in there and I don't really understand it, but it's infrared light.
Is that the technical term?
Yeah, it's infrared optical thing.
Okay.
Thingamajig is a technical term, but I don't want to get too scientific for you people.
Scalar laser interferometer.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Now, Shelley Wright, now she's the assistant professor of physics there at the University of California, so she's a little bit more intelligent than we are in this room. But she actually led the development on the new instrument, she says, and she says that infrared light would be an excellent means of interstellar communication. Which brings up a good point right there, because you're talking about faster and you're talking about less messing with it. It's interference, what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
Less interference. And she even talks about with them searching for it, it's actually cheaper on us to look for it than it is for us to be able to shoot radio waves and do all that.
Well, think about this, guys. You know what I mean? And I can totally see why Open Minds would carry that story. You know, Stanton Friedman and many others in the UFO community for years have been the ones talking about the fact that, you know, really our radio, you know, the hope of using a radio telescope for purpose of communicating, you know, with our, you know, our radar dish fields that you see, or, you know, even something as elaborate as what they have at Arecibo in Puerto Rico. You know, a radio telescope methodology applied to the study of, you know, extraterrestrial life and the possibility that they're using this, you know, or similar technology for communication. It is kind of archaic when we think about, you know, the advances in laser optics and the like that we would be able to apply to a not only a more reliable but perhaps a less expensive method of communicating, and one that would not take. I mean, again, when we're talking about radio waves versus the speed of light.
Mm-hmm.
The time that it would take for these signals using, again, you know, a radio telescope, you know, the time for propagation of the message from Earth or, you know, for, of course, if it were an alien species to be sending it to Earth, what we may receive, that's not to say that they've never done it, but in likelihood, if we were to receive a radio signal from deep space, from an alien civilization, you know, that would be, again, in terms of light years, so far away that we wouldn't even be able to travel that distance in our lifetime. It could very well be the case where we are finding evidence of a civilization that may be long gone by the time we actually interrupt that signal. I would wager that probably a highly advanced civilization has already moved on to more advanced means of communication, and the great silence, in a sense, might also be attributed to, rather than there being a lack of evidence for alien life, we are not equipped with the technology to be able to discern a highly advanced extraterrestrial intelligence, i.e. we have not met their standards of communication technology. And once we do, maybe we'll find that the world, you know, the universe is teeming with life once we know how to look for it.
Well, and you make a great point. Well, Frank Drake, which is one of the pioneers of SETI, even goes on in this article to say that in addition to it being more affordable, a more affordable method for searching out this alien communication, he says that infrared signals are so strong that you only need a small telescope to even receive them.
Yeah.
And he says that smaller telescopes can offer more observational time, and that's good because they say they need many, many more to search for all the stars in order for a chance for it to happen. So that's an idea, is you can find something that's stronger in a smaller sense, and more people can do it. That's
absolutely
an ideal thing.
Yeah.
Well, are you guys familiar with the WOW signal that happened?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, so that people say, have we ever been contacted? I think there's a small portion of people that think that we have.
You know, the WOW signal's, you know, been one that's been, I think, to an extent, you know, called into question, because there are a number of different ways that radio signals can be naturally mm-hmm. occurring and can be detected from within deep space. But what's interesting is that, you know, there, I don't know, remember the name of the facility, but there was a facility a few years ago in Australia that was already conducting.
I remember that.
Utilizing, you know, an optical variety of communication or you know, reception, signal reception, and they had already claimed that they had, you know, literally seen the kind of thing on par with or better than what we determined with the WOW signal, which was, what was the year that was?
1977, August 15th.
I was off by a year. I was going to say 76. I'm usually pretty good with the dates. People's names, I'll never forget a face, but I'm like dyslexic when it comes to names. Yeah.
There's Jerry R. Amon.
There you
was
go.
The astronomer. Now, this happened at Ohio State University, I believe. At an observatory there. Now, the burst that we're talking about was a full 72 seconds.
Yeah.
But they've never been able to detect it again. So
that was the WOW.
The WOW, yes, okay. Yes, not the Australian one, yes.
Now, not to rule it out entirely, by the way. You know, I tend towards skepticism, and that's, you know, I'm not going to get off on a big argument about skepticism.
We're going to reel you in. We're going to reel you in.
I'm just going to say, actually, I will just say this much. Sometimes I loathe the idea of you know, skepticism in terms of what it has become, you know, and I find myself, no matter how skeptical I can be, the quote unquote real skeptics are displeased with there not being enough skepticism being espoused by yours truly or anybody else. I try to balance it, and I tend to think that sometimes that, you know, even I become a little too skeptical. So I don't want to sound like I'm just to the point of being cynical. I think that there's a fine line between skepticism and cynicism, especially in the modern approach or the modern skeptical movement. And there are other people within that movement who will tell you the same thing. So I just want to say, I don't want to sound like I'm being cynical. Who knows? Maybe there's something to that. And you're absolutely right. It, you know, the WOW signal, for whatever it may have been, or maybe what it, you know, whatever it was or was not, it remains singular in the sense that it is something that, well, it caused us to go WOW then, and we haven't quite explained it yet.
Now, speaking of SETI and everything, now that I have both of you here in front of me, what do you think about broadcasting a signal out to interstellar space? Because there's a whole group of people that yeah. say that they warn against it.
Cam, like, says nay.
You know
no.
what I'm saying?
Why do you say nay? Yeah,
the same reason I said nay about riding on that UFO.
Oh, yeah. And for those who
I'm
don't,
not about that.
For those who don't know what he's talking about, riding on the UFO, we actually did a brilliant Graylian X panel discussion.
I was like, what?
Well, you know, I've had you guys on a couple of the Graylian X panel discussions. It's so cool we're going to be doing it live here on the free podcast so that people, and if you've been living in a cave like Sasquatch, and we'll talk about that here in a few
we're
minutes.
We're getting there.
If you've been living in a cave for the last, you know, few centuries, and you don't know about the Expanded Perspectives podcast, the website is expandedperspectives.com, and of course you can download the podcast on iTunes just as well. But these guys, good friends of mine, is obvious, you know, since I'm in their studio and we're doing this program live from the Bunker South here at Skeleton Studios. So, but now, when it comes to, and if you want to hear what Cam's thoughts about actually taking a ride on UFO would be, you know, if you're a Graylian X subscriber, just dig up that episode, which you'll find in the archives there at Graylian X. So far as, you know, broadcasting a signal, active SETI or quote-unquote METI, you know, Kyle, my personal opinion, I don't think it would be that bad an idea, actually.
Yeah, you know, you're never going to know till they show up and you're like, uh-oh, we made a mistake.
Well,
but, you know, I don't know.
Let me tell you why I don't, I'm not as cautious about it as some people. And Cam, maybe you won't agree, but, you know. We were talking on which show was it? I think I was on James Swagger's program the other day, Capricorn Radio. And we were talking a bit about philosophy in general. And when it comes to philosophy in relation to these subjects, I got to tell you that I really think that one of the big gripes I've had in recent years, and I've talked about it a lot, so I won't belabor the point here, but Sir Stephen Hawking saying that philosophy was dead. Many have laughed about the fact that, you know, to make that kind of an assessment is actually in itself sort of it's a philosophical argument in itself. His argument is based on the idea that he says that philosophy has not kept up with science and therefore it is dead, and science is, you know, leading the way into the future of human understanding. Philosophers retorted, well, if philosophy is dead, which philosophy is dead? We might say chemistry is dead. It's not, by the way. But if you said that chemistry was dead, you wouldn't be saying that science is dead. you and me saying by virtue of the death of chemistry that also we have, you know, seen the death of physics. There are branches of science just as there are branches of philosophy. And so philosophers respond and say, Mr. Hawking, Sir Stephen Hawking, why would you say philosophy is dead? Be more specific. Which branch? Sure, maybe there are certain branches of philosophy that we could, you know, even though I, you know, don't frankly think that it's warranted to say that it's dead, but we could still say we could, quote, bury certain classical philosophical lines of inquiry, but that doesn't mean that philosophy itself is dead. Now, I bring all this up because we were talking about this, and in relation to the what I think is overtly the anthropomorphized view toward alien life. I won't just say alien life. I'll say, when you know, when we're talking about alien, I mean extraterrestrial in this sense. But, you know, I think the anthropomorphized view toward non-human intelligence, and I'll use that term specifically because I think that non-human intelligence is a good catch-all term for extraterrestrial aliens, artificial intelligence, you know, transdimensional beings, any number of different manifestations. Heck, you know, if we were ever to find, as in the book The Descent by Jeff Long is discussed, you know, we find that there is a, you know, an entirely separate species of human-like beings living underground, cave creatures, the Hadals, which we, of course, in the bunker know all about. What we learn from these sorts of revelations, of course, you know, that being a fictional one, but the idea that there are other intelligences apart from humans is now we have to, take into consideration their culture, their beliefs, their values. So let's look at the idea of extraterrestrial life for a moment. If we're going to talk about alien life, extraterrestrial beings, is it safe to assume, as Stephen Hawking has done, that, well, if they come here, that we are going to probably be all the worse for it because we see what happened when, you know, colonialists... European settlers come to the New World. They meet, you know, what, of course, were the American Indians. And then we see what happens. And history has shown that they didn't fare any better in those circumstances. They were much worse for it. But see, I say that, you know, and this is what I said to James on the show. I said that as we implement more and more technology, I think a lot of people are kind of, you know, what would you call it? Technophobes, I suppose. But I'm not. I embrace technology within reason. And I find that the more and more technologically advanced that civilizations are, or I should say that, you know, here on Earth, since that's all that we really have to compare it to, when we began to compare the way that people in modern civilized society work more and more toward actually attempting to raise the bar, getting along with one another, and through the utilization of intelligence and through, active communication, the implementation of technology, that we actually seem to be less prone over time to be involved in wars and to be involved in conflict. Sure, we can look back at the Middle Ages, we can look back, you know, at the Renaissance period, and we can still see evidence of, well, you know, people who are more sophisticated and advanced are going to take advantage of those who are less advanced and civilized. But if we were to colonize an alien planet and find less advanced intelligence on that planet, if we recognized it as being intelligence, would we take advantage of them?
Oh, absolutely. I think we would.
You think we would?
We exploit everything we touch.
We
are destroying the Earth at a rate that's incredible. And we already know that it's not the right thing to do.
That's a good point.
But absolutely. But
I look at like Star Trek and I think about the Prime Directive, you know? If we get to a point where maybe we will actually reach out into space ourselves, would we carry our values? Would we? Are we going to send our oil tycoons into space? You know, in other words,
if there's money or they find a way to mine an asteroid, you guarantee there'll be companies
that
they're doing.
That's who goes after things now.
Well, you
know, it's not peacekeepers that go, you know, into the jungles looking for material to build an iPhone.
Maybe I'm just overly optimistic.
I want to be optimistic.
I want to be too, really, but do. I mean, we never are stopping. I mean, we're just assuming that we're going to have infinite growth. And we know it's a finite planet. I mean, there's only a certain amount of resources. It's impossible to continue to go at the pace that we're going.
You know, but I guess the question would be, though, you know, let's say we have two planets. We find one planet that's, you know, like Earth's moon, you know, rich in helium-3, and we think that we could utilize this, we can mine this and use this for fusion or something along those lines. And then let's say that we go a little further out and we find a planet, but we, lo and behold, land on this planet and find out that there is an intelligent civilization. Now, by intelligent, they're on par with, you know, maybe our Middle Ages. You know, they're warfaring, they're angry, but they're not technologically sophisticated, and they're not really capable of defending themselves on par with the advancements that humanity has brought. But would we go in and wipe them out? Would it be the likes of which what we have seen in the past? You know, again, I would argue, and I would hope, I think, that in the future, the more technologically savvy we become, the more conscience that we have in relation. Maybe I am being entirely too optimistic about this, but you know, we see that reflected in science fiction, and I would like to hope that humans would recognize the necessity for camaraderie, for communication, and for cooperation, the three C's of interplanetary contact, right? So maybe I'm being too optimistic, but you know, I think that, again, especially coming back to aliens coming here, if we were to beam signals out there, Sir Stephen says, well, you know, that may not fare well for us. We may not be the better for it, and so we shouldn't probably advertise our presence. And so he worries that it could be concerning. You know, maybe I'm just an optimist, but I say that, you know, in truth, first, we're anthropomorphizing our views of aliens, and second, maybe they wouldn't be so evil and wicked as many would presume.
I want to be optimistic with you. I do, man. I want to bad. The only thing that I keep going back to in my head, and I know it's ridiculous, but in my opinion, that's all it is that we already have an alien on this planet that is extremely advanced, that we treat terribly, and they're dolphins. They live in an alien universe compared to what we live in. There's nothing ties them to anything. They can swim 360. I mean, it's basically a 3D world that they live in. We know they're intelligent. We know that they basically have names for one another. They have their own languages. Different dolphins in different areas of the world have separate languages of the way that they communicate. Yet look what we do to them.
You know, that's the big question. Maybe the biggest concern of all is the idea that if we were visited by aliens from outer space, would they recognize us as being intelligent by their standards? Maybe dolphins, you know, are the... As a matter of fact, I've got a friend in academia who put the idea to me once that he said, you know, what if dolphins are the intelligent, you know, the real intelligent species here on Earth? You know, there are different levels and different modalities of intelligence that can manifest through, you know, with or without maybe consciousness. We've got a lot of questions. We have very few answers, and we're not really very close to summing this all up and coming to direct conclusions about that kind of a thing or any of this. But, you know, gosh, it really makes your brain hurt when you really get into this and you start talking about it, you know. It's incredible. Talk about expanded perspectives. Dang.
Well, in case anybody's interested, too, don't forget now, they just put this technology we were just talking about with the infrared locator and all that stuff was just activated March 15th of this year. So everybody keep your eyes peeled on the news. We'll see if we don't hear anything. Maybe we'll find something real quick. Like Mike said, we might be able to flip a switch, and they may be trying to broadcast this whole time like that. And we just now figured out a way to hear them.
And they're going to, oh, yeah, and likewise, you know, it very well may be the case that, you know, the implementation of such technology may put us on someone else's radar. And they'll say, oh, you know what, the monkeys down there on Earth, they were intelligent all along.
They finally figured it out.
You know, before we wrap up this hour, I want to come back around to something, not a paranormal story, but in terms of the Missing Persons Bureau, you know, the Missing 411, as it's colloquially begun to be called, thanks to David Pilates and his books. There was a story that the Huffington Post carried today looking at the remains of what may have been a family of four that went missing in Alaska. There were remains discovered on a trail that some are saying could be linked to these individuals. Now, Rebecca Adams, age 23, and her two children, Michelle and Yaraka, and also Adams' boyfriend at the time, Brandon Yividen, age 37, were last seen in late May at their apartment in the Kenai Peninsula town. There's only about 7,000 people there. Their family of dog, the dog named Sparks, had vanished with them. That's interesting because, you know, again, you know, when people go missing, it's one thing for a dog to go missing while the family's out on the trail. It's another thing, I think, for, you know, for the family to go missing and the dog disappears with them. You know, you'd think that the pet's found wandering around and, you know, hey, who does this dog belong to? They find it. I don't know. It may sound more like something from a film. I just found it very interesting, for whatever reason, that the family and the dog had gone missing. Now, they say that the sudden disappearance had spurred one of the biggest search efforts in the Kenai Peninsula and has been, you know, since the actual disappearance, that this has made national headlines numerous times. So on Sunday, Dennis Giffords of Kenyai, who happens to be Adams' uncle, I should point out, had asked for privacy on behalf of Adams and Yevinden's families because they say that human remains and clothing were found on a trail northwest of the Alaska city on Saturday night. And they do believe that this may be linked to the family that went missing. He says, you have a shred of hope that they will be found, he said, and that shred has now been taken away. This according to Adam's uncle. Now, all that changed again when a person driving down a trail in the area northwest of town between Alpine Drive and Borgen Avenue discovered the remains and called the authorities. That's really about all that we have right now about this. The Alaska Dispatch News, I think, is going to be producing updates, and we'll see if this comes about as evidence of the remains of the missing family. But I never cease to be amazed by these missing person cases. And you guys were actually just talking a little bit about missing persons in Alaska. Back closer to home in Asheville this past week, there had been a pretty interesting development in a longstanding missing persons case that I'd been wanting to get into on this show. And that was the disappearance of Zeb Quinn. He was a local boy in Asheville, North Carolina. I think he went missing, in 2001. Zeb Quinn was last seen on Hendersonville Road entering a gas station. I think he'd been with Robert Owens, and Robert Owens had been the individual who had given the testimony that Quinn and he were going to look at a new car that Quinn hoped to buy. But Quinn started flashing his headlights at him and prompted him to pull over. He said that his car was actually hit by Quinn, you know, in his vehicle he was driving at the time, because he was in such a hurry to leave. He told Owens that he'd gotten a page and had to leave in a hurry and didn't say what had happened, and then he takes off, and supposedly this is when the rear-ending of Owens' vehicle occurs. Owens would be the last person that we know of that would see Zeb Quinn alive, and a couple of weeks after the fact, his car appears in the Little Pigs Barbecue parking lot across from Asheville High School. And the car had a pair of lips drawn in lipstick on the back window. There was a hotel key card that couldn't be traced to a hotel on the interior of the vehicle. There was a black, I think, Labrador puppy that was found inside. And also there was a jacket that was too small to fit Mr. Quinn, in addition to the fact that the front seat had been moved forward, the driver's seat, closer to the steering wheel than would have been comfortable for Zeb Quinn had he been driving it. Zeb Quinn has never been found, and nor has there been any significant lead, I think, in the case. But now there has been an incredible development just in the last few days. I had seen a story pop up on my Google News feed that had been noting that an individual connected with a missing person case had been arrested. And it turns out that Robert Owen has now been arrested. Owens was arrested in conjunction with suspicion surrounding the deaths of two individuals, a man and his wife, and she was pregnant at the time. He had been formally charged and now, as I understand, has admitted to not only killing the couple, but also to maintaining, I think, a burning in his backyard, which had clued neighbors in on something, you know, what they perceived as being suspicious activity. And indeed, he has admitted to having disposed of the bodies. This being the last person who saw Zeb Quinn alive, I sincerely hope, if we haven't got it yet, of course, that justice will be served. We haven't seen justice in the Zeb Quinn case, but I'll tell you this. What I do hope for is that he's been charged now and has admitted to the murders of two other individuals. Being the last person who saw Zeb Quinn alive, I can't help but think that there might be a possible connection. I mean, doesn't take a rocket scientist, huh? And I hope that maybe there will be indeed some closure with this long-standing case back up in the hometown of the Graylians in Asheville, North Carolina. But coming to you live from Texas, I'm Micah Hanks, and we'll be back again right after this. Stay with us.
Is the Graylian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Graylian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
Rocking out across the airways, live from Texas, in the studio of Expanded Perspectives, Cam and Kyle, Skeleton Studios. That's where we are right now. I'm Micah Hanks, your host as always, Monday nights from 6 until 8 p.m. East Coast time, which of course the time zone's totally throwing me off tonight. But I'll acclimate as I'm traveling. I like to travel around this time of the year, and I'm glad to be down here in Texas spending some time with my bruds. from expandedperspectives.com. And, you know, this hour we're going to get into a little bit of Bigfoot talk because my introduction into town last night, I travel all day, I get off the plane, I drive 10 minutes to the home of Lyle Blackburn, and we were treated to a tour of one of the best crypto museums I think I've ever seen. I won't give away too much right now. We'll get into that a little bit later. But I do want to bring up Bigfoot before we get into a little bit of discussion about the mysteries of Texas, because I have just got to tell you, I am so utterly fascinated with Bigfoot. I am just completely taken with the idea. And I don't think that that means that, you know, I want to go and give up my day job and become a quote-unquote squatcher. I don't think that that means that I'm necessarily going to give myself to blind faith in the subject and the belief in there being a Bigfoot. But even if it were nothing but a sociological phenomena in that people seem to believe in this madness, or the, as Nick Redfern, who we're going to be spending a little time with here in Texas tomorrow, Nick couldn't be with us tonight, but Nick and the Expanded Perspective boys and I are going to be traveling around to some of the sites, which we'll be discussing later in this hour here in Texas. Texas has always seemed to be kind of a hotbed for the strange. Yeah, and there is a certain amount of Bigfoot activity that occurs down here just as well. And I got to tell you, even if it were just a sociological phenomena in that people say that and claim that and have claimed for years that they continue to have these encounters with man-like beasts, that alone would be a mystery worthy of study to me. But I think sometimes that there's got to be a little more to it. And you can laugh if you want to. Jane Goodall doesn't laugh. There are plenty of people. Dr. Jeffrey Meldrum doesn't laugh. Dr. Bernard Hevelmans didn't laugh. And, of course, we've got people like Ivan Sanderson and many others who have, of a background in science, nonetheless maintained a sincere interest, a passion, and even a pursuit that lasted throughout their lives in relation to their interest in the Bigfoot subject. And so, you know, it doesn't take a Hevelmans, it doesn't take a Sanderson or a Goodall to look at the possibility that based on the anecdotal evidence, there may be something to this. And I can't help but keep coming back to that. I'm truly fascinated by the Bigfoot equation. And on my way down to Texas, before I came down to meet the guys here, I was reading and trying to blast through and finish this copy of John Napier's book from 1972, Bigfoot. And I've actually had this for years, and I've off and on read this thing over the years, and I wanted to read it again because I have often said to people, why would you watch a film or read a book more than once? But, you know, and my logic behind that is, of course, you know, you read something, you obtain the knowledge. Some people love certain books, you know, so much that they'll read them again and again because they enjoy it. But in terms of trying to acquire knowledge, I have even myself been guilty of saying at times in the past, well, but, you know, you've got to acquire new knowledge. Why read the same books over and over again? Well, I'll tell you, though, with a book like this one, Napier, again, was a very skeptical guy. I mean, this is, you know, at one time he served as head of primatology at the Smithsonian, though he's an Englishman. And he maintains a very skeptical disposition throughout this book. But I come back to it after, you know, I read it years ago and remembered looking at it as just being a book that presented more evidence of something I already had made up my mind I believed in. Whereas now, having stepped away from the belief in Bigfoot, and I look at this book and I listen to the way that he breaks down his reasoning behind why the Patterson-Gimlin footage is a fake. Yeah, that's what he thought. He didn't buy that story. He was skeptical of Albert Ostman's disappearance, which we talked about on Enigmas this month. He was very skeptical of a lot of these stories, and yet at the end still comes to that determination that, well, I don't think there's much to Yeti, okay, in the East, but I think that in North America there's got to be something. It may not be all it's cracked up to be, but there's got to be something behind Bigfoot. And, you know, I feel like if we want to try and understand Bigfoot, I keep coming back to this and I feel a conviction for this idea more now than ever before. There may not be a physical creature out there for all you or I know, but I think that if we want to get to the bottom of what the Bigfoot mystery is, whether that be a physical entity, and I really strongly suspect that that is part of what's going on here. I don't think that this is an imaginary phenomenon, but let's just assume that it were. Either the physical or the psychological phenomena, I think, we would be able to make finer determinations about if a serious, proper cultural anthropological study were carried out in relation to this. And Cam, you know, you and I were talking earlier about the way that
we look at different cultures and the bizarre nature of cultures, and some of the stuff we were talking about. We were going pretty far down the rabbit hole, so we won't go there right now. But I can't help but look at some of these stories and go, you know, if we sought to understand ourselves and the cultural variances and the differences between how people on the other side of the world, people in a less civilized society in terms of modern civilization and the amenities afforded us, you know, the ability to be able to go to the kitchen and pick up a bottle of water, you know, or to pick up a cell phone and make a call, or to, you know, have a studio, you know, next to your house, you know, a fully functional broadcast facility. I mean, there are some people who live, you know, in a month off of the less than the cost of a fast food meal, you know, that will sustain you for one night here in America. And, you know, when you think about all the varieties of different cultural interpretations among humans alone, and then we presume that rather than being a beast, that like Napier said, that there was, or maybe a creature out there that is, rather than being a man-like beast, something that is probably more a beast-like man, we start looking at this in the human context, I just feel that cultural anthropology and good science would help us learn an awful lot about this. And I know that we're kind of, you know, especially with the genetic studies, you know, that Brian Sykes is, of course, you know, popularized in this newer study that's now calling into question some of those results. I'm glad to see that, however you choose to look at it, that there's some good science being applied to the Bigfoot mystery. But let me just tell you something. Genetic science, okay, and the study of RNA has helped us determine, according to Sykes, that there may be a bear species we didn't know about. A more recent study is now calling those findings into question. 1972. John Napier, based on just an examination, he again coming from a primatological background, but he had already come to the determination that in likelihood a bear species was probably the impetus behind the reports of the Yeti.
Absolutely. And I mean, so many of these sightings happen where people have these encounters, they're not prepared for them. Lots of times they're just on a hike or they're driving their automobile. If you're not really familiar with the woods, if you're a city slicker, like they call them down here, you know, and you just get a brief glimpse of something, your imagination, I mean, everybody knows that eyewitness testimony is spotty, very spotty. I mean, people can look at a lineup and they can't even identify the person that just committed something maybe an hour prior. You know, I think people get a glimpse and your imagination kind of gets the best of you, and you kind of fill in the spots to make it. And if you believe that Sasquatch is a possibility, especially for all these groups that go out squatching all the time, in fact, we were talking about that with Lyle Blackburn last night, I can very easily see where somebody's like, man, I saw a Sasquatch. Because there's no doubt to me, I've spoken to tons of people that have claimed to have seen Bigfoot. Now, I can tell you this, some of them I didn't believe, some of them I have, but what I will tell you is some of those people absolutely saw something. Now, what it was,
well, they
I do
believe
not
they
know.
Saw something.
People that me and Cam have spoken about on the show, they've completely changed their life. They don't go camping anymore.
Really?
They refuse to hunt.
They're
they
frightened
sell
by it,
all
then.
Their stuff. I mean, yeah, this, I mean, I'm talking about men that were Vietnam veterans and guys that they're not going to be scared of a bear. You know, I know guys yeah. that they've been bow hunting for years. They've seen something.
Like Cam, who's been bow hunting yeah. for years. But he's never seen anything.
No, I have never seen anything either. Nothing like that.
I've talked with a lot of hunters, too, though.
But you know what I mean? So these people, some of them definitely are not making it up. It's shaking them to their very core. So there's something there. But yeah, now what it is, I don't know.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's the big question that I have. You know, I was taking notes when Cam and I were sitting here, and I just have to commend these two. That, you know, despite apparently our audio player misfiring, and that was with my equipment, my travel equipment here, you know, a little earlier in the program, but we made it through. It's all good. As a matter of fact, most of the listeners probably don't know the difference, and that's always what we seek to try and achieve here. But, you know, we've got a brand new board in this facility and other additional equipment that these guys invested in just prior to my, attendance here. At Skeleton Studios, and I really got to thank you guys, you know, for you know, really putting the work and the effort, you know, into just this single show. And of course, I know that's going to really help out, of course, with the Expanded Perspectives podcast as well. But it's just really great doing this with you.
Well, I was just going to say, we release a new show every Monday, and if you're a fan of Expanded Perspectives and you didn't get that new episode today, that's exactly what happened. Micah got here last night. No joke, our old soundboard completely went out
and we were at a mad scramble all day trying to get the new one operational.
See, the right? shadow government trying to silence us. They don't want us talking about Bigfoot. Yeah, everything blows up the night before Micah arrives. This happens everywhere I go. So if you, any of you out there who are entertaining ideas of me being a guest in your home at
think
any time,
again.
Yes, yes, because there very well may be a strange case of arson or what appears to be as such before I arrive. Just be careful. I'm warning you. Now, Cam and I, earlier today, as Kyle was actually literally purchasing the board which we're using now, and I have to say this is an impressive unit. I promised I wouldn't talk about his unit on the air. But,
phrasing.
Yes, phraseology, Micah, yes. But Cam and I, we were...
That's what she said.
We were talking a little bit about some of the points in this book that I just love, and I was taking notes in addition to the cultural attitudes toward Bigfoot. And you know what got us talking about all this, by the way, was an article that Nick Redfern had written that was over at mysteriousuniverse.com. And in the article, he was... the article's actually titled Sasquatch of the Underworld. And the general premise is that, of course, he says in the early 1900s, a number of stories surfaced in Oregon press that upon careful reflection might offer a degree of support for this particularly intriguing theory that Bigfoot is very much a creature of the underground. And in specific, he gives this report that I think you can find. It's at the Center for Forestian Zoology blog, talking about Not Another Kangaroo. The story had involved a couple of individuals. This had been reported in 1900, by the way, that the Oregon Press, and it described that in a mining district in Curry County, Oregon, that there had been a lot of stories about what they called a kangaroo man. Now, this is really strange that he would be called the kangaroo man. The story of the kangaroo man is kind of funny because there apparently was this case where this Mr. William Page and Johnny McCulloch, who were miners in the area, they'd gone out hunting, and McCulloch had claimed to see a strange animal man, as it was described, come down to a stream and drink. And in calling Page's attention to the strange being, it became frightened, and with cat-like agility, he said, which has always been a leading characteristic, with a few bounds, was out of sight. Now, it says, Nick offers this commentary. He says, despite having been given the extremely odd nickname of the kangaroo man, the newspaper's description of the beast is actually far more Bigfoot-like. Here's the description given in the newspaper article. The appearance of this animal is almost enough to terrorize the rugged mountainsides themselves. He is described as having the appearance of a man, a very good-looking man, 9 feet in height, with a low forehead, hair hanging down near his eyes, and his body covered with a prolific growth of hair which nature has provided for his protection. Its hands reach almost to the ground, and when its tracks were measured, its feet were around 18 inches in length with 5 well-formed toes. Whether this is a devil, some strange animal, or a wild man is what Mr. Page and Mr. McCulloch would like to know. And there were other reports that continued over the next few years, but what Cam and I were looking at in relation to this is that, again, you know, we're talking about the early 1900s. And I find that, again, in terms of trying to understand how people might have sought to reconcile with such a report, you know, what exactly are we talking about, for instance, when we talk about the way that people in that period of time actually would have interpreted a report like this? We look, for instance, at the discovery of gorillas, and of course, you know, we have the actual specific name, the genus, you know, dating back to the 1840s, at which time they were called troglodytes. But then I think in 1852, the name gorilla first was utilized in terms of, you know, taxonomy. But, you know, we go back to some of these reports of purported encounters with wild men before that time. And even in the early 1900s, there weren't comparisons being made. These things were not being described as being gorillas, and rightly so, because when you encounter something in North America, specifically in Oregon, which there are no known ape species that are believed to be or supposed to even exist in that realm or in that region of the world. And yet what we have is we have people describing encounters with what they describe as a wild man, but much larger, covered in hair, that leaves big footprints. Many would call this a hoax, but then again, you know, the same sorts of stories are still reported today. That goes all the way back to the 1900s. And so what I asked you, Cam, was, is this a question of whether or not people at that time knew how to phrase this? I mean, what do you call something that looks like a man but behaves like a beast? You know, they didn't call them gorillas. Maybe in a few instances they did. But I can't help but look at a case like this and say, you know, are we looking at instances where these creatures are being described in ways that today we would hear of an ape-like creature, you know, mm-hmm. known as Bigfoot, whereas back in the old days, you've got your wild man reports, and they were struggling to find a way because of, you know, the necessity of having to have something to even compare that to. They were struggling to find a way of describing a creature that has remained actually, in terms of its physical description, incredibly, incredibly consistent over the last few hundred years.
Yeah. Well, just so people can wrap their head around exactly what we're talking about date-wise, as far as these sightings that are pre... Basically, we didn't know the mountain gorilla even existed until a specimen was brought in 1902. It was actually shot and killed in 1902. Now, they were skulls and bones found of it as early as pre-1850, 1847, right. 1840. But in 1902 is when they actually laid a hand on it. So it's a lot like the crypto stuff that we deal with today, especially Bigfoot, is... The only way that people are really going to take it serious and want to move forward is if there's going to have to be a specimen. Now, I know that's hard for a lot of people to hear, but that's the truth. I mean, it's not good, it's not bad, and there's arguments all the time of, will the death of one species save the lives of many species? If there was, let's just for the sake of argument say that there is a huge government cover-up in the Pacific Northwest due to logging.
Right.
Because there's a lot of money involved in it.
I've heard that theory.
Okay, let's just say that that's what's going on. Well, in order to get that shut down, you are going to have to prove that that species is there. So it's going to take the death or capture of one of these species for study for them to go, that's where it came from. Now we know what we're looking for. There's no more activity in there. That's what it's going to take. So the death of one or the loss of one could save the lives of the rest at that point. So when you wrap your head around the fact, okay, what were they talking about? And you and I had discussed, people talk about wild men.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only way that they can actually, I guess, they can categorize what they laid their eyes on. But, and I told you, I have a feeling, and I'm still 50-50, until I have an experience myself, I love to listen to all the stories, I love to talk to everybody that's had the stories, and I don't doubt it, you know, but until I have an experience myself, I can't say without argument that there's something out there. I don't know. I'm open to all of it. Let's see what it is. I can understand how you can argue against it. You know, I could argue that they wouldn't exist, and I could also argue that they would. I just have a feeling that if they're there, they're closer to man than to ape.
More and more over time, that is what I begin to feel just as well. And again, coming back to Napier's book, you know, because he gets into talking about the Almasty of Russia, which we also talked about a little bit, mm-hmm. Cam, but there's this passage towards the end of the book that I actually want to share here, in which he brings up Louis Leakey, of course. The famous Kenyan anthropologist, and he notes the fact that it had been Leakey that had posited the idea. This book written in 1972, and yet I enjoyed, I think, mostly rereading this and comparing all this with what I learned from my anthropological studies in more recent years. And I'm comparing this to the nature of Sasquatchery as we see it today, which reminds me of what Kyle and I spoke about over coffee this morning, which was the modern snipe hunt that is what I call squatching, and maybe we'll get into that in a minute. But this passage from the book is really interesting, and he writes, John Napier, that Louis Leakey has, let's see, actually, where's the point here? He gets to the point, recently it's been suggested by the world-famous Kenyan anthropologist Louis Leakey that humans were occupying North America between 60,000 and 80,000 years ago at the time when the Neanderthal were living in Western Europe and points east. Now, according to Leakey, the evidence for this assertion has been discovered at the foot of the Calico Hills near Yermo in South California, where a large collection of very crude stone, what at the time at least were believed to be tools, had been excavated from an old alluvial fan. Now, the issue is whether these, quote, tools are man-made or are natural phenomena, and maybe by now that's been determined. But here it writes, most geologists and anthropologists in America do not find the evidence for human technology very convincing. Even, however, if this material could be shown unequivocally to be man-made, there is no evidence as to the identity of the toolmaker. In the spirit of the, as what Mr. Napier refers to as the goblin universe, which I think is really his own skeptical nearing that approach that Nick Redfern does when he brings up the absurd nature of cryptozoology and the idea that, well, Bigfoot is seen in the UK, but how could something like a Bigfoot exist in the UK? It seems damn near impossible. And so he says, in the spirit of the goblin universe, might one suppose that these very early North Americans were Neanderthals themselves? I don't know, though, that skipping ahead, I just don't want to take that quote out of context, because later Napier actually says that it seems very strong, the argument against the idea that Neanderthal or that you know, even a species like, you know, early humans that somehow carried over and existed, maybe Homo erectus. It would seem very unlikely that those would be the Bigfoot of today. More likely, you know, equally implausible, but more likely would be that Paranthropus, something like that, or maybe, of course, Gigantopithecus, mm-hmm. from Asia had crossed over the same land bridge, which, of course, brought people who first settled the Americas into the regions. And perhaps there is an eighth species. And there have been many, like, you know, anthropologist Grover Krantz over the years who have really championed the Gigantopithecus idea. Gigantopithecus, I think, is at least a strong possibility, but still there's a lot about that creature that we don't know. And Napier points out something that's very important, a real salient point that should be addressed, that the idea that the creature was, you know, 9, 10, 11 feet tall really might not be the case, and that really based on what we see with the teeth and even the fragment of jaw that had been discovered, that that's not enough information to really make a strong argument for a huge, giant 8. But now if we were to say maybe a 6.5 to 7 or 8 foot tall creature, perhaps more likely a knuckle walker. You know, again, Krantz had said that by the shape of the jaw, it would have provided room for a trachea, which would have actually suggested that the head might have been mounted, you know, on top of the shoulders rather than jutting forward like a mountain gorilla, and therefore it was at least possible that this creature, based on what we actually do have in the fossil record of Gigantopithecus, that this was an upright walking hominid. But I would still maintain that in likelihood something that large, and looking at the teeth, by the way, the teeth, of course, are quite obviously indicative of something that was, a plant eater, an herbivore, I guess, you know, to put it in the technical sense. But we're also talking about a creature that I think that due to its sheer weight, in likelihood maybe, would have been prone to knuckle walking, just to be able to help carry the mass of a creature so large. So I find that interesting, you know, and I don't rule out Gigantopithecus, but I just like to bring up all those points, you know, from, I think, as John Napier was attempting to do, from a very rational anthropological and primatological perspective.
Well, and I think you're right, but I think it's also one of the ways that's almost the way that we categorize it now, is because of the things that we know. So for us, it's easier to categorize it as Gigantopithecus as it is a wild man, because whereas 100 years ago, it was easier to categorize it as a wild man because they didn't know about apes. Well, now we know about all these apes. It's still easier for us. I know it's easier for me to want to think it's just some prehistoric, you know, ape, as it is a real, maybe a devolved human, maybe a, not even going to get into where we, how far we went, but
yeah,
maybe it's along those lines. Maybe it's still more man-like, because I talk, to me, it's always these two things. Either they really do have some sort of interdimensional magic that they can actually do for the ease of travel, that they can come in and out and vanish into thin air and just appear and on all these things. And people talk about how they feel, and some people report infrasound, you know, all this, or they actually have a brain much, much closer to ours, and they're extremely intelligent and can actually, that's why they slip and slide and get in and out of places as well, as because they're not just animals. They're extremely intelligent people.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm putting it out to the chat room for the live listeners to see what they think about Bigfoot, what it is, maybe how we can come to terms with it. If you're not listening in the live chat room, of course, info@graylianreport.com. That's info@graylianreport.com. You can email me. I would love to hear from you if you have had a one-on-one encounter, if you have seen something that you believe qualifies as being a wild person. It may not have to be a Bigfoot. I'd be honestly more interested to hear if you saw something that you would call a wild person. But if you saw a 8-foot tall hominid in the Pacific Northwest, I'm equally interested, I suppose I'll say. So info@graylianreport.com. I would just love to hear from people who feel that they've had their own personal encounters with something like this. And of course, on the Graylian X podcast, just for Graylian X subscribers, it's an entirely different show once a month that Dakota Waddell and I are doing that features Crypto Talk. We're going to be talking a bit about sea monsters here in a coming episode, but we've done a lot about Bigfoot already, and we will continue to do in the future. But I'm asking people what they think about Bigfoot. A Night Sky in the chat room says, you know, personally, I believe it may be interdimensional. I guess we can't rule anything out. You know, I like to stick to the flesh and bones argument, though, only in that I think that if we're going to prove whether or not there is a missing, you know, species out there, something that is believed to exist but unproven to science, you know, we have to look at this again in a biological and an anthropologically significant way. But you know, like you said, you can't remove all possibilities. We've got Wolf who says it may be able to. Hold on. Actually, I got to back up there. That's part of a second point here. Yeah. Yeah, the chat room, actually, people are typing so quickly I can't keep up with everything that they're saying. We have Swift that says, I lean toward the Native American explanation of Bigfoot, that there is a tribe of exceedingly cunning wild men of the forest. Interesting, interesting stuff. So,
well, Wolf brings up a really good point. Have the drone or heat signatures done by satellite, so the military must have it. So, and he's, you know, they're right. The military must have it. And also, we've talked about, Kyle and I have talked about off air multiple times, is with SpaceX and Elon Musk and all that. How long before it gets to be affordable to where a group could get together and purchase their own satellite and you can do these type of things?
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, I've long said I want to buy a drone. And where I'd love to take it is to the Pacific Northwest, where some of these kinds of reports stem from. Who knows? Maybe, again, technology is going to bring us to a new understanding or determination about a perceived unexplained phenomenon. We'll pick up right there when we come back here on the Graylian Report. From the deeper south, I'm Micah Hanks. This is the Graylian Report, broadcasting live from the Expanded Perspective Studio. Having a great time talking a little bit of Sasquatch. Kyle and I, we were having a little chuckle this morning as we were talking about this. Because I've said that what you see in, you know, I respect everybody's attitudes. I'm not an attacker. But I just got to call this like I see it. A lot of what I see on the television programs about all this, it could be compared, I would say, to Skype hunting, okay? And what's interesting about Skype hunting, by the way, is that, you know, I've, like a lot of people who are indoctrinated, I guess, at an early age into this mystery, this mysterious creature known as the snipe, I too was taken out into the remote wilds of Appalachia, handed a pillowcase, and said, this is how you catch a snipe. And, of course, my question at that time was, now, well, how do I catch something? I don't even know what it looks like. What does a snipe look like? Well, a snipe is best defined, I was told, by the way that you capture it. And it's funny because a typical snipe hunt would involve, well, clacking sticks together, making a lot of noise. You have to make a specific kind of a call, and you want to try and draw the creature in close to your campsite. If you've ever watched a television show that features Bigfoot hunters in the wild, The Weekend Warriors, you probably, this sounds very familiar to you, I'm sure. But what's even more interesting to me about the whole squatching phenomena and the comparison that some might make to a snipe hunt is the fact that, as I only learned a little while ago, and I was telling Kyle this morning, you know, first of all, talking about the snipe as being, you know, an actual shorebird, there is the fact that I believe that the term snipe hunt actually had to do with the idea that a shorebird like a snipe is extremely hard to shoot, and a wing shooter, you know, a sportsman would know this, and hence, you know, the idea of trying to catch a creature that is impossible to catch or near impossible. This is where the term snipe hunt comes from, but it actually goes a little deeper. In fact, there are certain conservationists still who would employ the technique of utilizing a light and a gong or some similar object, you know, that will emit a droning noise that is used to create, interestingly, a sensory deprivation-like state in the actual bird. And it's not just snipes, but a variety of different birds that will roost low to the ground at night. And one of the methods of capture that has been honored in many traditions over the decades has been the use of, again, a source of illumination that is held out in front of the individual as they approach the bird, and they strike the gong to make a low droning noise, which effectively obscures from sight the individual behind the light, as well as the sound of the footsteps approaching, and very simply with the low droning of the gong and the appearance of the light, which kind of blinds the bird in question to the optical depth that one would have ordinarily, blinded and, of course, unable to determine the sound of footsteps approaching, a bird can easily be snuck up on and lifted into a pillowcase and then stored where it, you know, of course, won't be harmed. And funny enough, this is also very similar to the description of the snipe hunt, and actually there's a little more behind it than I even realized, but I maintain that the point here is, of course, that people going out and making noise, you know, and hunting a creature at night that's almost impossible to catch, Bigfoot and hunting it is so much like snipe hunting, it's not even funny. There's an obvious connection to be made there, and so Kyle and I had a little laugh about that this
morning.
Yeah,
it's like the adult version, right?
The adult version, the modern adult version of snipe hunting. We upgraded from snipes. We're looking for Bigfoot now. And when we talk about looking for Bigfoot, you know, I want to get into talking, since we're down here in Texas, let's get into some Texas talk here. And we can actually kind of allow the Bigfoot stuff to spill over into this discussion, too, if we want to. While we're here, I had wanted to try and, get out and see some of the hot spots in this area. And one of the first ones that comes to mind is Lake Worth. And we were talking about this last night when we visited Lyle Blackburn. I got to tell you, Cam had said, we've got a surprise for you. We're going to go see Lyle Blackburn. Yeah. And literally, Kyle and Cam picked me up from the airport, and we drive to Lyle Blackburn's house, and he brings us. We were able to identify his house, a wonderful home in his neighborhood, by the Bigfoot sign on the front doorstep, you know. And as we entered their wonderful home, he and his wife and their lovely little daughter, we were treated to so much incredible history.
Yeah.
Cryptozoological history. Like, for instance, you know, the original hand-painted artwork that was used in the first Boggy Creek poster. And, I mean, this stuff, this is just incredible. He had the mask from the second Boggy Creek film.
The script.
The script from the film.
The original script from the second film.
Yeah, he had a copy of it wasn't just Bigfoot stuff. There was a copy of the death mask of Vincent Price.
Mm-hmm.
All kinds of memorabilia. Truly, truly incredible. And talking with Lyle, it's incredible, not just because of all the stuff that he's collected, but also increasingly over time, the merit, I think, as a researcher that he brings to all this. I find Lyle to be such a stand-up guy. We stand in his living room talking with him, and, of course, you know, we're greeted with hugs. And Lyle, I hadn't seen Lyle. We've talked a couple of times since then, but I haven't seen him since the summer of 2012, before the first Paradigm Symposium. He and I met at a conference in Sacramento, and we were so excited to be able to get together and hang out a little and talk. And, you know, he's expressing all the same issues with the state of the affairs in the field that the three of us or anybody else have talked about, and that I've certainly rambled about on my program plenty. You know, in that we are faced with, I think, a cult of belief and this kind of a flippant kind of a snipe hunt that is, you know, propagated through the media about what belief in Bigfoot is supposed to be, where there are and have been serious anthropological and primatological studies, you know, or at very least researchers who have studied the subject in that way, who try to bring a degree of integrity and legitimacy to the discussion. And I can see that while I think that people are honest-hearted and they're of good intent by trying to get out there in the field and prove this once and for all, what I fear the result inadvertently often can be is that by getting out there and trying to prove Bigfoot exists by hunting the thing in the woods, that doesn't really do anything in terms of the academic viewpoint to legitimize the subject. If anything, I think it kind of brings it down, you know, to such a fundamental level that it's laughable. It's a snipe hunt.
Exactly. I mean, the only accredited person that really gives any real dedicated study to it is Meldrum.
And poor Meldrum, by virtue of doing that, is also the laughing stock,
that's
you
right.
know, among his
yeah.
peers. I really feel for the guy. I mean, I really, really do. And you know, Lyle mirrored a lot of these same, you know, issues that we had with it. But anyway, I mean, I could talk all night about that, but I did want to bring that up because, you know, I value Lyle's opinion, and it was really great seeing him and of course, all his incredible Sasquatchery, you know, in his home. But, you know, the discussion of the Lake Worth monster did come up, and that might be a good area to springboard into. We probably won't have time to get to all the cool stuff that's happening down here in Texas and has happened over the last few years. But, of course, Lake Worth, you know, one of you guys, you want to start with this, the Lake Worth story?
Yeah, well, you know, the Lake Worth story was back in July of 1969, and I think it was first seen by a young couple that was probably making out or something in a car. And what's interesting to me is the first accounts of the Lake Worth monster, it wasn't so much like a Sasquatch, but more like a fishy-scaled goat.
Fishy-scaled?
I mean, they said it looked like it had fur and
scales on
and horns. It had horns.
I mean,
on its head.
That's a really odd.
That's weird
description. You know, and you know now time. You know, through the years, people have probably was a Sasquatch or something. But if you really look at the way it was described, it didn't come out that way. And there was times where it would throw. One case, it threw a whole wheel with a tire still attached to it, not just like an empty tire, at some people. And I mean, it's really bizarre. Now the area that it's located on is actually Greer Island.
Yes.
I mean, it's called the Goat Man, but it's really not on Goat Island. It actually happened on Greer Island, I think, which is just a little island inside the lake.
Mm-hmm.
And at one time during the 1920s, Lake Worth was a real prominent area. I mean, they used to have I don't know if it was a casino, but they would have big fairs and balls and dances. And it was where the people went to hang out and party and stuff. It was a really popular area.
Well, there was a paddle boat on that lake for a long time, too. When we were kids, yeah. I still remember that.
That's right. Yeah. And so these stories have happened. Now, it only happened. There was only a couple cases of it, 6 or 7 cases. And maybe, what do you think? Maybe 20 people might have been witness to the things. And then it's just died off since then. Now, every once in a while, there still is a case where something nearby has happened. And I've actually spoken with people who told me that they've had sightings or smelt some strange odors, you know, not very far. Yeah. And it's almost like whatever this thing is, it kind of follows the estuaries or little creeks or canals.
Yeah.
And, you know, and if you think about it, where did people live, you know, if you went back a couple hundred years? Well, everybody kind of stayed near water. And if you were to travel south or north or whatever, you would kind of stay within close distance of a major river because, you need it. And so I think that if there are these migrations of, you know, what is considered Sasquatch or something, maybe that one was moving through the area at that time.
Well, you're right. And what people... I'm sure it's like this everywhere else. And, Mike, I'm sure you've dealt with it about the Brown Mountain Lights. There's always a big dust up. When it first happens, a lot of people are involved. A lot of people come forward.
Yeah.
And as that activity and interest dies down, you don't hear much of it anymore. And everybody thinks it's all over. And like Kyle talked about, we've still heard stories of sightings and things and encounters that still go on recently. I mean, people still bumping into stuff and claiming they see and hear things and smell things. You know, it's like last year, little things like that. If you kind of hear it now without really researching, we haven't gone in to talk to a lot of people yet about it. But you still get these, oh, yeah, I saw something about, you know, a month or so ago, or I saw something last winter out there. So it's still going on, little things. You know, now it's nothing like this. You know, it's nothing like throwing tires or I believe what was it? The one guy, I'm trying to think his last name was like Burson, but he talked about having a big tear down the side of his car.
Yeah, that's right. It's like a large scratch
like a big,
along
like
the car.
A big 18 or 20 inch scratch on the side of the car.
Remarkably similar, by the way, to some of the Lizard Man reports
yes.
that Lyle wrote about in
yes.
his follow-up book.
That's right. Yeah, the Skateboard Swamp, right? Was that South Carolina, actually?
Yeah, yeah. I've been there, as a matter of fact. A good friend of mine, Patrick Green, actually, he wrote a book called Progeny, which is a fiction book about Bigfoot, but he's a very serious researcher as well, and his brother Egan and he actually went down before it became, it's kind of more built up now, but they actually spent some time at Skateboard Swamp and, you know, camped in the back of a pickup truck. I mean, could you imagine doing that after what was described in that area? But yeah, the similarities between that story and, again, the quote-unquote half-man, half-goat with fur and scales, look, I take that with a grain of salt, but you know, people at least were apparently reporting something, whether or not that is an accurate description of whatever it may have been, they were claiming that they had seen and encountered something in this area. Now, you know, the interesting thing about the Lake Worth Monster is, if I remember correctly, I think that the very first article that appeared in the, was it the Dallas
The
Star?
Dallas Morning News.
Yeah. Dallas mm-hmm. Morning, yeah. Jim yeah. Mars, actually.
That's
our,
right.
Our friend Jim Mars had actually written that article. And Jim, I think Jim's out of town. I'd hope to see him while we were down here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I was going to say, as a child growing up in this area, of course, the elders and uncles and things would always tell you about the Lake Worth Monster. Which, you know, and it wasn't until recently that I even realized that the Goat Man isn't only local to this area, Texas. It's seen all over. We had a recent author on, J. Nathan Couch, who wrote a book about Goat Man. It's called Flesh or Folklore. And he gets into all these stories and sightings from all different parts of the United States where it's very similar. I mean, he was talking about one, a guy was bow hunting. He was in his stand. And I don't remember if it was morning or evening. But anyways, he was sitting there and he saw a satyr just come walking out of the brush in the crowd. It didn't see him. And he said it was like cursing under its breath, but
mumbling,
not at him.
And cursing.
Like it was just mad.
But was it cursing in English?
Could yeah.
Yeah, that's what he, the guy that had the sighting. That's what he claims that he saw.
And it walked off. The lower half looked like a goat. The upper half looked like a man.
I don't know what to make of somebody.
He said he panicked. The dude got down, panicked. Well,
yeah,
took
wouldn't
off.
You?
He just like ah.
I had to clean my shorts out.
He said when
out.
It was
I
out
mean,
of sight, he ran. He's like, I'm
oh,
out.
Oh man, that's just incredible.
But there are these sightings of goat man or these satyrs and things, and this has been going on not even just in North America. So what is this? This is a common thing that we get into on our show is. What is this that people from all over the world are seeing Sasquatch, whether it's Yowie, Almasty, Yeren, whatever the name, they're all seeing these common things. Same thing with this goat man, the same thing with the boogeyman, same thing with all these shadow people and stuff. It seems like every culture has their own story of a beast like this. So to me, of course, not all of it's real, but there's got to be some truth there. So what is that?
Absolutely. You know, changing gears and going a little further back, let's go all the way back to April 19th, 1897, okay? We've got the an article from the Dallas Morning News, same area right here, by S.E. Hayden, and it reads as follows. About 6 o'clock this morning, the early risers of Aurora were astonished at the sudden appearance of the airship which has been sailing through the country, a continuation of those famous airship reports from the late 1890s.
I love those, too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, steampunk before it was steampunk. And, you know, the report from the Dallas Morning News reads, it was traveling due north and much nearer the Earth than ever before, and evidently some of the machinery was out of order, for it was making a speed of only 10 or 12 miles an hour and gradually settling toward the Earth. It sailed directly over the public square, and when it reached the north part of town, collided with the tower of Judge Proctor's windmill, and went to pieces with a terrific explosion, scattering debris over several acres of ground, wrecking the windmill and water tank and destroying the judge's flower garden. Now, it's interesting because it says the pilot of the ship is supposed to have been the only one on board, and while his remains are badly disfigured enough that the original has been picked up to show that he was not an inhabitant of this world. You know, he was purportedly buried, in fact, and I believe that tomorrow we'll be traveling to the location of the burial with Nick Redfern. And that's just one of the many mysteries that's been reported of this area, you know. But there's one I think that really strikes home, that really really fascinates me more, I think, than any other. And we're gonna take our final break of this week's edition of the Grayling Report. I cannot believe how quickly the time has flown by this week. We're already wrapping up things almost. After this short break, we're gonna look at a more recent case from this area that may be one of the most significant. While I'm here in Texas, of course, you know we've got to try and follow up a bit on this, and some friends I have in the area don't want me to keep you in suspense, but you'll have to find out what we're talking about when we come back here on the Grayling Report. Join me on a continuing adventure throughout space and time. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Grayling Report, as I'm spinning cosmogirally through time and space in front of the master console here of a slightly different, I don't know if you'd really call this a TARDIS, but it's certainly a box, and there's certainly a console in front of us. I'm joined by a couple of fine companions, Cam and Kyle of Expanded Perspectives. Wrapping things up here, be sure and stick around a little bit because we've got Richard Dolan coming up, and of course later tonight my good buddy Jimmy Church. I wonder what Jimmy's going to be talking about. Always happy to hear from Mr. Church and the Fader Knots here on the one and only KGRA. Now that case I wanted to talk about, and speaking of KGRA, you know, Race Hobbs and I talked about this quite a while back, and he and I are both equally fascinated with this case. As we're spinning cosmogirally through space, join me on a trip back to January 8th, 2008. National media attention involves strange objects seen over Texas. The epicenter of that being, of course, Stephenville, Texas, when dozens of residents reported seeing unidentified flying objects, for lack of a better term. In fact, I was even sent a photograph, which I don't know if I've shown you two, but you're going to see it tonight. And I've got pictures up at GrayleighReport.com, but there was a, these of course were in many instances described as large triangular-shaped craft. And a peace officer in Texas had taken a film photograph that was sent to a friend of mine, which I was sent a copy of, that shows a triangular-shaped craft with points of light at the three corners and then two orange orbs ascending toward this thing. And it's one of the best UFO photos I think I've ever seen.
Wow, yeah. I definitely want to see that.
This, of course, taken from during the you know, this wave, this UFO wave that occurred in 2008 around Stephenville. Now, you know, again, there were a lot of things that were happening with this, of course, that included the strange affair of Angela Joyner, who is, I think, you know, I've never met Angela. She and I were friends on Facebook, and she had been a journalist who was trying to document these cases, and it led to either her actually having been fired or having walked away from the job, but basically she lost her job writing for the newspaper in the area as a result of her insistence on reporting on this. And, you know, I think, like a lot of us in the community, I look at that and I say, good on her. You know, it's unfortunate that came about, but, you know, she was, very, very, very resistant to the pressures not to write about UFOs in the popular sense that we see so often today. Now, you know, this story was featured on Larry King's television program, and according to Steve Allen, a private pilot who had witnessed one of these UFOs, he had claimed that this thing had been traveling extremely fast, and he said that it supposedly reached, according to one account, 3,000 feet in the air while traveling at a high rate of speed. He said it was about a half a mile wide and about a mile long. His word for it was humongous. He said whatever it was. And, of course, there have been a number of these sightings featured not only on my own blog but also on television programs. I think UFO Hunters did an episode about it just as well. So what happened at Stephenville? And, you know, again, one of the questions I've always wondered is, you know, why hasn't there been more written about it? There is a website devoted to this. And I think Angela Joyner, of course, contributes to a lot of that literature that we have. But we're here in the epicenter. How far are we from Stephenville right now, guys? Where we're sitting right now?
An hour.
An hour.
Yeah. That's without hustling.
What was going on? I mean, there was the gentleman who had said that there was a strange man coming around his property at night. He'd been getting threatening phone calls, all in the midst of this strange series of reports of sightings of triangular-shaped objects seen over Stephenville, Texas. Now, what the hell was going on down there? And as far as a UFO wave in modern times, you don't hear a lot about these kinds of things. And that is the most significant and the most recent consistent UFO wave that I recall occurring here in the United States.
Well, and what's funny is Kyle and I did a segment on it. Oh, it's probably been close to a year ago that we were actually talking about this. And we got a lot of email and things and a lot of hate mail about it because we found some, it's hard to say, because it was almost like a dividing line. We would find
some conflicting stories for sure.
We would find stories that where it sounded like it was nothing more than flares. It really was. What a lot of people saw were flares.
A military exercise.
That's right. And then we found stories to where it sounded like there was a craft. And it almost sounds, without going crazy conspiracy, like they scrambled all that to put it in the sky to have something and a paper trail to brush it off towards without really addressing what people actually saw.
There's Carswell Air Force Base is not that far away. It's in Fort Worth. And numerous witnesses said that they scrambled F-16s. They saw them. But I'm with Cam. Some of the stories seem like they not only scrambled these F-16s, because that's not deniable, but that they told the guys start releasing some flares, too, just like he said, to cover their
or at very least
their behind,
to,
you know?
Yeah, and to allow them to be able to say, yeah, we dropped flares. And
yeah, we were just
a paper trail.
An exercise that night. That's all people saw. Nothing to see here, people.
Nothing to see here. Move along.
Yeah. Move along.
Look, personally, there's not enough time to get into really what may or may not have been going on. I'll leave you with this. I think something was happening. I've seen photographs. I've heard testimony from people. I'm fascinated. I think that there is more to this than meets the eye. Whatever that may be, who knows? But there was something that happened in Stephenville in 2008. Tomorrow, I will be heading out into the field with these individuals here in the studio with me. Thank you to the boys from Expanded Perspectives, by the way, for joining me here in studio and making your facilities available to the Graylians for this live broadcast. Looking forward to getting out doing some field research with you tomorrow. And that's going to wrap it up for this week. On behalf of all of us here at Graylian International, Caleb Hanks, Tyler Pittman, Matthew Oakley, Chris Hayes, John Anderson, Dick Oakley, Jeremy London, Racing Robin Hobbs back at Master Control,
Cam and Kyle of Expanded Perspectives, and of course, yours truly, Micah Hanks, the mouth of the South. As always, we bid you adieu, my friends, and until next time, stay strange. From the Lone Star State, I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report.
You've been listening to The Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website, GraylianReport.com.